Last week, we've seen a pogrom on the streets of a major European city. Donald Trump's Republicans have won the House, and we've got a closer look at his political appointments and economic plans. One of those appointments could have a huge impact on the Middle East, and Russia may be trying to accelerate their war in Ukraine before President Trump comes into office. We'll get into all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. My name is Richard Palmer, assistant managing editor of thetrumpet.com. And Hitler and the Nazis are back in the USA. That is what we've heard from European news for more than a week now. But a massive and shocking piece of news from Amsterdam last Friday exposes that as a lie. If we're worried about neo-Nazis, it's not the United States White House that we need to look. It is radical Muslim immigrants that have come into Europe en masse and are being permitted to carry out just extraordinary attacks on Jews that come straight out of the 1930s. Last Thursday, Israel's Maccabi football team faced off against the Dutch Ajax in Amsterdam. A lot of Israeli fans came to watch that match. After the game, we saw shocking footage come out of mobs hunting down Israelis and really just anyone that is Jewish for that reason alone. There was all kinds of footage of people hunting down, you know, demanding to see passports for people to prove whether they were Israelis. There were mobs lying in wait for people on street corners. There were reports of people of cars deliberately trying to ram individuals. And we saw some incredibly disappointing responses from all kinds of authorities. We saw very quickly major media outlets around the world, including the BBC, trying to kind of put more blame on the Jews and shift the narrative, try and make it sound like the Jews had provoked this, that these Israeli football fans had behaved aggressively and provoked this. When A, there was very little evidence, and of course B, you know, tearing down a few flags or some of the, or making some chants the way that they were accused does not justify that kind of violence. Instead, what we have seen since then is this looked like quite an orchestrated, premeditated attack, largely made up of Dutch Arab Uber drivers. So there were WhatsApp messages, Telegram messages that we've now seen where they're messaging each other saying things like, tomorrow after the match at night, part two, Jew hunt. And they're coordinating how to target all of these Israelis and Jews that were coming here. One of the first attacks came near a casino where a lot of these Israeli fans were staying, where the security guard had been sending messages to a lot of these Uber drivers and had been part of it. And this helped kick off a lot of that violence. By the time the evening was over, five people had been hospitalized, dozens more were injured. There were fears that Jews had been kidnapped, that you could have a potential hostage situation. There were worries that people were missing. The Israeli government was so concerned that they sent planes to go and evacuate Israeli citizens, which is just astonishing. Like, this is not Israel having to send in airplanes to bring its Jews out of Syria or out of some North African country where you might typically think about having this unrest. This was a Western, sophisticated European capital. You know, the type of place that you'd have thought had really committed to never again. And what made this all the more poignant was that this attack came just a couple of days before the anniversary of Kristallnacht. This start or milestone in Germany's persecution of the Jews in the lead up to World War II. And this happened in the home of Anne Frank. This is a place that has put a lot of effort into memorializing the Holocaust and that attack on Jews. And yet this kind of violence, this kind of attack was allowed to happen again. I think there's a couple of important takeaways from this. I mean, one is these attacks, this was not Dutch citizens, and these were not, you look at the videos, and it's not tall, blonde-haired, Dutch-looking individuals chasing down Jews. They all clearly from a Middle Eastern background. You know, the mainstream media will shy away from reporting that or saying, well, Muslim-looking, Middle Eastern-looking. But this is a way, very clearly, that Europe's approach to immigration is undermined never again. That they are importing people with very radical ideologies into Europe. And that, I think, is an important takeaway. But at the same time, you do have this response that I alluded to from the mainstream, from the media, from authorities that allowed this to happen. I mean, you look at the Dutch police, and you had reports even coming back in October where some whistleblowers spoke out. They said that there were colleagues that no longer wanted to protect Jewish targets or events. So, you know, where the Dutch police, this was ahead of the attack, this wasn't in context of that particular attack, but if the Dutch police are saying we don't want to defend Holocaust museums because we don't want to be defending Jews, did that impact how well policed this event was in Amsterdam? So you see it in the Dutch authorities' response. And like I said, I think you see it in the way that this was reported around the world, and that there was a big push from left-wing media outlets initially to try and blame the Jews for somehow triggering this, which is exactly the same way that they responded to October 7th. Like, you get this massive, outrageous attack from terrorists with a Nazi ideology, and immediately a lot of the media try to make out that somehow it's the Jews' fault. You had the same thing in Amsterdam. And of course, the news comes out many days later showing actually these attacks were premeditated. They came several days in advance that people were planning these attacks. This wasn't a response to what Jews were doing. But I think also, just like, this is from a New York Times article, even after this came out, where it talks about Israelis desecrating the Palestinian flag. I mean, that the way that they described that just really got me. I mean, how many videos have you seen of radicals across the Middle East burning the Israeli flag? And that's never described as desecration in the Western media. So, yes, a lot of this story is about imported anti-Semitism from the Middle East. But when you look at some of this response from authorities and from the media outside, and media outside of the Netherlands as well, and you also have a story of more institutionalized anti-Semitism and authorities that, okay, maybe they're not actively conspiring to attack Jews, but they don't really have a massive problem with it happening. And I think that also shows, has Europe really learned the message of never again? And Simon wrote a lot of this up. I've been summarizing his article, and you know, he's sitting right next to me because we're going to go to the Middle East later in this discussion. I would like to bring you into this now. See, like, do you have anything to add? Anything of significance that I've missed out? Because you got into this story in quite a bit of detail.
There may have been, I guess you could say, willful negligence on the part of some of the Dutch authorities. The Mossad, Israel's foreign intelligence agency, sent warnings to their counterparts in the Netherlands that something like what we saw was going to happen. And apparently, the Dutch authorities, the federal authorities, just let it slide. And the mayor of Amsterdam, for her part, said, yeah, we got no warning from anybody higher up from us that anything like this was going to happen. And there is an investigation going on right now in the Netherlands to see what exactly went wrong. But an Israeli team coming into a big European city with a large Muslim population, at the very least, it should not have taken a warning from the Mossad for at least some people to be wondering something like this could go a bit dangerous, and at the very least, take some of those warnings seriously. That didn't happen, and there are a lot of questions as to why not. Tying in with the overall context, I think it's interesting if you look at parallels, say, with Kristallnacht. We look at that today as like that was one step before Auschwitz, like it was the building block, etc. At the time, I mean, Hitler was in power for a few years now. Everybody knew that he was a dictator and he did not like the Jews. But a lot of people in Germany and a lot of people observing outside of Germany looked at that and going, whoa, that was way too far. Look at those barbarian, brown shirts or whoever, doing this thing to these innocent people. And to the point that where Hitler gave a speech not too long after, and he didn't even reference what had happened. He talked about other things because he knew how controversial it was. Even again, if this is just or mainly a problem within the radical Islamist community within the Netherlands, just because there's a lot of people that are outraged about this. And there are a lot of people in the Netherlands, including the government there, that are really shocked at what happened and are wondering why it happened and condemning this and thinking about ways to move things forward. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this was a one-off episode and that everything's stable except for maybe the small segment of society and we're going to be fixing the problem immediately. It's symptomatic of the global climate that we're in with all the protests we've seen in other European capitals like London and Paris, of hundreds of thousands of people of desecrating the Israeli flags and a lot of other things, and the government letting that go, and a lot of ordinary people being among the, shall we say, the jihadi crowd.
I think that's a good point. Like it's a two-prong problem. It is a radical Muslim being in Islam being imported into Europe problem, no question. But and this is m way more than a Dutch issue. If this was any other group being targeted like this, you would see a much bigger response from the mainstream. So it also exposes a mainstream attitude towards the Jews. I mean, if this was Christian mob running amok, hunting down homosexuals after some kind of homosexual pride event, if it had had one hundredth of the violence, this would have been, I think, front page probably every day since then. Like,
We'd probably be talking about it for years.
yeah, exactly. And there would be, what, there were 63 arrests, I think, from this. Maybe there's been more since then. I think you mentioned in your article those arrests were mostly related to things that happened prior to that running amok. But you would have thousands of arrests if this had been, say, this a Christian group targeting homosexuals. If it had been Muslims that had been attacked by some other group, again, I think this would be absolutely, absolutely massive. I mean, you look at in Britain with Sir Keir Starmer, or Tutia Keir as he's been christened, how many people have been arrested for the so-called anti-Muslim riots that took place over the summer? And they were a lot less violent. You know, I said it was a lot less one-sided. You know, there was some violence. There was violence on both sides, people confronting each other. But I don't think there were as many people hospitalized as went on in the Netherlands and things like that. So, you know, that this was a bigger deal than what we saw over the summer in Britain. And yet we have seen the government go and arrest people for what they put on Twitter. And just this week, there was a prominent Telegraph journalist. The police showed up on her door on Remembrance Day, you know, the day we remember those that died in world wars to preserve freedom. And the police are knocking on her door saying, "You've been accused of a hate crime." She thinks it's related to coverage of that attack. She said, "Well, who's my accuser? What am I accused of?" They said, "Well, we're not allowed to tell you what you're accused of. And in fact, you can't call your accuser. They're the victim." So the police have apparently judged her guilty before she stood trial. Yeah, that's the kind of thing we saw when there was accusations of violence against Islam. But when it's violence against Jews, now we'll move on. Like it became a big news item for a day. People have kind of forgotten about it already. There is no big outcry. And of course, this is a, well, sorry, go on.
Okay. The Free Press actually had a really good take on it. They, fortunately, cannot remember the guy's name, but they had a columnist who was a member of the Netherlands Jewish community. And their take was they're surprised that more people are surprised at what happened because the Netherlands, as well as many other countries, has been struggling with this kind of problem for years with blatant, like jeering about being Jews from people on the street. And the government's usual response to that is, maybe a barbed wire and bulletproof glass in synagogues, and then outreach programs for interfaith dialogue. You know, when people are trying to kill you, interfaith dialogue is I guess you could say, a cop-out excuse for we don't really want to deal with the problem. We don't think it's that serious enough. We're just going to keep doing what we're doing.
If you live in Europe and have never visited a synagogue, it is eye-opening to go to a synagogue. I remember the first time I went to a synagogue about 2 decades ago. Like this is not new. Like is it? This is not new at all. I mean, maybe a decade and a half. And it's one of the highest security buildings I'd ever been to. Like you can't have a window that is not barred, and the whole perimeter has to have a fence with a single point of entry. And if you've got people coming and going, generally you'll have to have someone on guard. That was 15 years ago. Synagogues in Britain have to be fortified compounds almost because of the attacks that are just part of a normal part of that. Like, and again, if any other community had to live like that, that wouldn't be tolerated and it would be thought of as shit. I had no idea that that is what synagogues were generally like until I visited one. And it is a much wider systemic problem. Even going back to some of these attacks, you had like a Jewish youth soccer team in Berlin around the same time having to be put under police protection after they were attacked by a pro-Palestinian mob. And you know, they were shouting, they were chasing people with knives, spat at during the game. France is, I was reading an article a few days ago, they're ramping up their security as they're preparing for an Israeli game there. If you remember the Olympics, the Israeli team had to have all kinds of extra security as they were going on. So, you know, Islam and this Europe has imported a massive problem in the form of radical Islam, and the mainstream and the wider culture has turned a blind eye. So it's a dual problem, and I think we will see as a result of this is spurring people to stand up to radical Islam in Europe. And we've talked about this trend before where we do expect Europe to become a much more Christian and much more Catholic place. And so much of that is a result to problems caused by radical Islam. And I think that is shifting Europe in a different direction. You've already seen Geert Wilders, who leads the largest party in the Dutch coalition. He didn't end up being the Prime Minister. He's very concerned of what is happening here. He said what he called this a pogrom in the streets of Amsterdam. He said, "We've become the Gaza of Europe. Muslims with Palestinian flags hunting down Jews. I will not accept that. Never. The authorities will be held accountable for their failure to protect the Israeli citizens. Never again." So he's acknowledging problems in the Dutch authorities and he's promising change. So I think this will push Europe in that more right-wing Christian direction that we'll deal with a lot of genuine problems, I think, at least initially. But you're going to see Catholicism now play a much larger role in Europe. And ultimately, that's going to spur Europe into conflict with the Middle East. And that's going to lead to some massive, wide-ranging changes in Europe that go beyond, far beyond, standing up for the Jewish population, and actually ultimately lead to Europe being involved in the Holy Land in a very, you know, very different way to that. So that is an important trend to watch there. And then also just, we've raised this point before that you want to know if crisis is coming in the world. One very good way of looking at that is to look at how the world treats its Jews. It's an excellent barometer. You see this time and time again, and part of that is when people are unsettled, when their lives aren't going well, when there are major problems, they look for a scapegoat. Part of that is it is a spiritual barometer. And I had an article earlier this year, Truth and Lies about Anti-Semitism. There's a spiritual reality behind this that we need to understand if we're going to understand what is happening in these kind of attacks. So the Bible reveals there is a very real spirit world. And it talks about, you go to the Old Testament and it talks about evil spirits influencing world leaders. You look at the example of Jesus Christ, and he's constantly very aware of that evil spirit world and casting out demons and all of that. And Christians today don't talk about that very much and don't turn to those scriptures. But if you believe the Bible, that is very much in there and something that we need to understand. And you know, you look at the role that the Jews have played in preserving the Bible, in preserving the holy days, preserving the Sabbath. You know, Paul wrote that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. God used them to preserve scripture so that we have there. And then Jesus Christ chose to come as the descendant of or to be born of a Jewish woman. Like, there's a whole lot of honor that God has heaped on the Jews, and so that means that Satan has a special hatred for them. And so as you see Satan being more involved in world news and him being allowed to be more involved in world news, and here, you know, we talked last week, and we'll talk a little bit more in a second, about he's raising up a Holy Roman Empire in Europe that he's going to use to punish the modern-day descendants of Israel. Or he's going to use to attack the modern day descendants of Israel. One symptom of that is rising anti-Semitism, and that spiritual reality also plays an important part of that. I think that's also an important explanation for what we're seeing and why society considers it appropriate or doesn't have a massive problem with Jews being attacked. It's a much wider problem than just radical Islam, and it is a the fact that it is that much wider problem is a sign of the rising Holy Roman Empire, and I think it. That's why we're seeing this going on in Europe right now. And of course, it's not the only important story going on in Europe right now. Just to give you an update on the German election story that we were talking about last time. Germany's election date, it looks like that's being brought forwards. A lot of the country was outraged by the very slow pace that we talked about on last week's show. So instead of dissolving the government on January 15th and holding elections in late March, it now looks like Germany will dissolve its coalition in December and then hold elections on February 23rd. There are a lot that want things more quickly. The center-right Christian Democratic Union, they want parliament dissolved now and elections in December, for example. But they've accelerated that time scale. But keep watching that important story as Germany now gears up for elections, and I mean, as Germany already now has a leadership void, watch for a strongman to come to the fore and take advantage of that leadership void. The New York Times commented on this earlier in the week. They had an article, Missing in Europe, a Strong Leader for a New Trump Era. The world sees this, that Europe is missing a strong leader. And it's not just at the German level that Europe's leadership is really struggling and there is a complete absence of leadership. The coalition that leads the European Parliament is also at risk of falling apart. It's a centre-left, centre-right coalition. And each centre-right group, like that one, is a coalition of various different European centre-right groups. So that is extra unstable. Arguments over job appointments could make this whole thing fall apart. You've got Spanish parties arguing now over Spain's candidate for EU commissioner, who would have a very senior role in the EU Commission that really is the European kind of government executive. She was the former environment minister. Spain has recently had catastrophic flooding, so there are important questions being asked about the environment ministry and how they confronted flooding and the way they encourage smaller dams to be destroyed and what responsibility do they bear for that. So there's disagreement within the Spanish parties that are both meant to be part of this coalition about her appointment. There's disagreements over Italy's candidate. All of this could lead to the European level government and this coalition that's been forming for months now falling apart. It's a reminder that the EU level leadership is also ineffective and an absolute mess. And really, we're looking for a strong German leader to come through and take the reins, not just for Germany, but all of Europe. And so when you see Germany in disarray, Europe in disarray, like we outlined in the show last week, we've been warning for years that a strong German leader will come in, and he'll come in through unorthodox ways. We've got an article coming in the next Trumpet print edition from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry about this. He compares it to kind of the way Kamala Harris was parachuted in as the Democratic candidate, where in that case there was that situation of, okay, there's an emergency, Joe Biden did terribly at a debate, we don't have time to have the normal debates and primaries and votes and all of that that would go into selecting a Democratic candidate. We've kind of got to parachute someone in. And he was saying, well, you'll see something very similar in Europe. That's the Kamala is an example of what we have been pointing to and saying for years you would see in Europe. And you could really see how for Germany and Europe being a mess, that could very easily happen. So keep watching there. And another symbol, I think, of Europe falling apart comes from the Netherlands announcing they're going to withdraw from the Schengen zone this week. So, this is probably the biggest, most visible symbol of European success that you can travel to France and then you can cross into Belgium and the Netherlands and Germany and Switzerland and Italy, all without having to stop and show your passport. Like, there used to be border checks along all of those where you would have to stop and it would be like crossing the US to Canada border and show your passport and how long are you going to be here? And when do you, what's business or pleasure and all of that? That's been gone. But a lot of that is starting to come back as countries put up their own borders. So Germany, Austria, Denmark, several others initially put up border restrictions. France put up their borders again. That was, I think, November 1st. Now the Netherlands say that they're doing it. Borders are going up all over Europe. Like, the European Union is failing and they desperately need leadership. So keep watching that important story. Well, talking of leadership, we're getting a better look at the leadership coming into the United States and how that's going to impact them and countries around the world. We'll turn now to get an update for that from Andrew Miller.
Yes, it is really amazing to see what Donald Trump has accomplished in just a week's worth of activity. He's filling cabinet posts and really clarifying his incoming presidential agenda. And one of the things that's going to be of interest, not just to people in America, but to people around the world, is his economics agenda. Now, here in America, the exit polls indicate that about two-thirds of American voters, roughly 68%, think that the American economy is in poor condition. And about 70% of those people who think the economy is in poor condition voted for Donald Trump. These are really the two big policy issues that brought Trump back into power, is American concern over the border crisis and American concerns over the economy. So Trump's very eager to reassure people that the economy in America is going to change. And that's really one of the things, one of the actions he's already taken, even though he's not going to be president until January, is he's launched a new task force called the Department of Governmental Efficiency. It's going to be headed up by Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. And this task force, it's going to be very transparent. Elon Musk owns X, so he's got a large social media bullhorn to use, where he's basically just going to be going through the department, going through the government, department by department, and publicizing for everyone in the world to see how much waste there is in the US government. And then by publicizing this, you can actually start building a public movement. That's the plan, anyway. Against governmental waste. Trump's given him a deadline, America's 250th anniversary, the 250 years since the Declaration of Independence is coming up in 20 months on July 4th, 2026. And so by then, Trump wants Musk to have a plan in place to make the American government smaller, leaner, more efficient. Trump's exact words were a smaller government with more efficient and less bureaucracy will be the perfect gift to America on the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. I'm confident we will succeed. Now, so far, the only cut Trump's announced is he wants to completely jettison the Department of Education. He's like, we really don't even need that. Each of the states can make their own educational standards.
Right, and
Right
education's
now, the
gotten
Department
worse
of
since the Department of Education was founded.
The America's stand ranking in math and science has plummeted since we've had a Department of Education. The entire organization is basically there to convince people that biological sex isn't real. It's deep into the like the transgender lobby. So that's going to be a big cut that's going to save about $280 billion. But Musk is going bigger than that. Like I said, he's only launched the Twitter account for the Department of Governmental Efficiency a few days ago. So he's starting to highlight examples of government waste. But I have a clip here where he, well, I'll let him tell you himself how much he's planning on cutting. We can play that now.
What a great group of people.
All right, I've only got one question for you, and then
Okay.
I'm getting out of here because
All
this
right.
is your stage. But we set up Doge.
Yes.
How much you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least 2 trillion.
Yeah!
Yes.
2 trillion.
I mean, at the end of the day, you're being taxed. You're being taxed. All government spending is taxation. So whether it's direct taxation or all government spending, it either becomes inflation or it's direct taxation. Your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that. We're going to get the government off your back and out of your pocketbook. And America's just not gonna, just going to be great. America is going to reach heights that it has never seen before.
Okay, so that clip was from a Trump rally a few months ago. And you see people getting pretty excited because he's saying $2 trillion from the annual budget. Now, Biden's last budget was about $6.5 trillion. And I think he only collected about $4.5 trillion in taxes, or maybe a little more than that. I think the last deficit was $1.6 trillion. So if you can cut $2 trillion from the budget, you're actually running about a $400 billion surplus. Would be the first government surplus since 2001, I think. A huge blessing to America if you can pull that off.
And there's a lot of countries, I think, very jealous. I've seen a lot of people in Britain, you know, looking very jealously on what Donald Trump is doing with Elon Musk. I mean, we just heard over the last week or so that the British government spent £100 million. This was part of a high speed rail project. The total cost of the high speed rail project was not £100 million. Instead, £100 million has been earmarked to build a tunnel to protect 300 bats. That's the kind of wastage that we have going on. I mean, the British government, they spend about $1 million on academic research into comics and race in Latin America. The government will spend hundreds of thousands on queer music theory studies. Like, we're wasting masses of money that, like, I'm sure the British budget and the American budget, I mean, could probably be cut in half or more, but that would be quite difficult. But there's also, it seems like there's a whole bunch of things that could be cut pretty easily that would instantly save a whole lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, and that is actually one of the most amazing things about this this project is, like I said, there's some departments like the Department of Education, they just want to completely jettison. But it looks like a lot of what Musk is talking about is not actually cutting governmental departments, but just cutting waste in those departments.
Well, I remember looking into some stories like this back when I was writing a piece on the U.S. military, because a lot of people look at the U.S. military and they say, okay, America's spending more on their military than any other country on Earth. Therefore, their military is overwhelmingly more powerful than any other country on Earth. And then you get stories like one where the Air Force spent over $300,000 each on coffee cups. Like, that has got to be a seriously nice coffee cup to be worth more than a house. It is incredible the level of waste that is going on in all of these different departments. One thing I have seen others point out, though, is, okay, Elon Musk can come along and have his engineers at Twitter or SpaceX or whatever ask, well, like, is this rule necessary? Is this job necessary? Okay, well, don't do it. When you do the same thing through the government, though, a lot of those rules are laws. And like Congress has mandated that this be done this way. How effective and successful do you think Elon Musk is going to be? Or do you think, like, it feels like we're always hearing from politicians, we're going to go to war on waste and nothing changes. Do you think we'll see things change?
Well, that really is up to the American people, because that is a good point, is like Elon Musk, this isn't like a private company where the CEO has hired an expert to come in and fire people for him. The Elon Musk is putting together proposals on how to cut government waste. And he's being very transparent and highlighting everything he's proposing on social media to the American people, so the American people can see for themselves how much waste there is. Because it's going to have to be the elected representatives of the people who do these cuts. As the head of the executive branch, there are some cuts Trump can make unilaterally just to make his executive departments more efficient. But there's other ones, such as like eliminating entire branches or entire departments, that you can't do without congressional approval. And so the hope is if this new commission highlights how much waste there is, that in the midterm elections in 2026, if people support what's happening, you'll get an even bigger mandate to cut this. Oh, I've written articles before, and we've had other articles before on the Trumpet saying that, like, really the national debt is not just foolish, but it's sinful, in that you're borrowing money with no plan to pay it back, and then giving this to your children. So now people who can't even vote are going to basically inherit a bankrupt country. A proverb says that a just man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And the current Congress has not left any inheritance for the next generation. So you have a moral duty to make these cuts. And it would be, in a small level, even a form of repentance to start making these cuts, not repenting of every sin you have, but at least repenting of the sin of, like, spending what you don't have, and robbing from future generations. And so if Americans get behind what Elon Musk is doing here, you could see some improvement going forward. But we definitely needs public support in order to make this resurgence permanent. We've prophetically, the verse we've focused on in this case is 2 Kings 14, verses 26 through 28. Which God, seeing that Israel's in bitter affliction and using an end-time Jeroboam figure represented by Donald Trump to save Israel temporarily. Trump and Musk can make some unilateral cuts to the executive executive branch that would create a temporary economic resurgence, but you need a public mandate to make this more than just two guys making some cuts for the next 2 years that just get reversed at the next election.
I think that's a really good point about the public support. And, you know, I think you see, like, everyone likes the idea of cuts. Everyone says, yes, it's important to me that we don't borrow money and that we fix the, but when it gets down to specifics, no one wants cuts that would affect them. And some of that is understandable. Like, I think Social Security, those having, like, we have been lied to about that for years, where the idea is you save in money and you get your own money back. And so people that have been told, well, that's what's happening, of course they don't want cuts to the Social Security and pensions and things like that, because that is their money that has been robbed by governments. That money is gone, it's now funded by some of these are very hard systemic issues to unpick, but nobody wants to accept cuts to something that would affect them. You have issues like pork barrel spending as well, where you have these massive bills getting published and you've kind of got to pay off this guy and that guy and this guy, and, well, I've got to give something to his state. And so, yeah, it is, there are things that I'm sure that they can do, and there are things as well, though, that are just much bigger issues. And when you drill down and look into these issues, so much of them are about character. Do we keep our word? Do we value keeping our word? Do we value, do we think about the future generations? Do we love the future generations more than ourselves? And all of that. So I think that's a really good point. I think we saw a lot more appointments as well, and announcements that give us a good shape of what's coming next from the Trump administration in the United States.
Yeah, well, there's definitely several issues where you could definitely see not just an economic, but a political resurgence. The one I'm probably most excited about is the one I've been talking about already, is this Elon Musk and this Department of Governmental Efficiency and trimming $2 trillion from the budget and cutting government waste, because that's going to involve a lot of firing. That's basically just going to make the bureaucracy in America smaller. And the smaller the bureaucracy is, the easier it is for the president of the United States, who, by the way, is the only man in the executive branch who's elected by the people, to control his bureaucracy. Right now, that's what we call the deep state. The deep state are like these 2 million bureaucrats who think they're not accountable to anybody. If you trim that down and make it smaller, it's easier for the one man who is accountable to the American people, Donald Trump, to actually control his bureaucracy and have some control over the government. Also, another big one, if I were to pick a second thing I'm most excited about in the Trump administration, is Matt Gaetz's appointment as the Attorney General. We've written a lot in the Trump over the past several years about basically just Obama weaponizing the deep state against his political opponents. And then all these really almost like treasonous coups with the Russiagate and the Steele dossier and things that they've used to take Donald Trump down. And during his first term, Trump said that he really thought that in order to like reduce the amount of corruption in the American government, we need to investigate these scandals. And so he appointed Jeff Sessions as his attorney general, who recused himself and did nothing. Then he replaced Jeff Sessions with Bill Barr, who talked a big talk, but also did nothing. And so now he's replaced him with Matt Gaetz, who's been instrumental in a lot of the congressional investigations. He's a congressman right now. He's in the House Intelligence Committee that have exposed a lot of what we do know about this left-wing lawfare against Donald Trump. So maybe we'll be disappointed for a third time, but there is a lot of optimism that he'll actually do what Bill Barr was too afraid to do and actually start exposing a lot of this corruption in the Justice Department. And then if you expose the corruption in the Justice Department, that makes Elon Musk's job easier to make the case to the American people, like, why you're paying for this? Who pays these guys? These guys who've done all this Russiagate nonsense. It's like they were paid with your paycheck. So it's like maybe if they're they either need to start making real justice in America, or we just need to start defunding them so you can spend the money on something better. So far, I mean, Trump's he's appointed less than half the people in his new cabinet. So there's going to be a bunch of appointments going forward. But so far, Elon Musk over the new Department of Governmental Efficiency and Matt Gaetz over the Justice Department.
So we've seen Matt Gaetz. I think we've also seen a new border czar announced. So movement on protecting the U.S. border as well.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I almost forgot about him. So much happening this week. But yeah. Yeah. But Tom Homan, who he's definitely talking a strong talk. Like I said at the beginning, the two issues the exit polls indicate are the biggest thing Americans want changed with the Trump administration is border security and the economy. Now, Elon Musk is looking into the economy and Matt Gaetz is looking into the corruption in the Justice Department. But this new border czar, he's really talking about actually enforcing America's laws. In my lifetime, I've never heard a Department of Homeland Security official talk like that. Now, whether he can deport the 12 million or so who are already here, that is a big question. There's definite Bible prophecies in Isaiah 1 verse 7 and other places about the punishment for Israel's sin, being the stranger within your gates, burning your cities with fire if Israel doesn't repent. So the indication is that if America doesn't repent, you're going to have these millions of illegals that Obama and Biden have let in participating in some pretty serious rioting. If Trump deports them all, they're not here to actually participate in that rioting. So there is reason to be skeptical that unless you have a massive sea change in the character of the American people, that he would be able to deport all these millions of illegals. But I don't think you're going to have a case where you've got 2 million new illegals crossing the border every year from here on out. They can at least keep that. It'll be tricky to get rid of the ones that are already here, but at least keep more from coming.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Well, one of the countries most impacted by the changes that Donald Trump is bringing in is Israel. We talked about this in depth on Wednesday's show, but since then, we got an announcement of a critical job vacancy being filled under the Trump administration that it has masses of meaning for Israel. So Mihailo Zekic is going to tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, on Monday, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich announced that...
Nice job on that pronunciation.
you get used to it after a while. But anyway, he announced that in 2025, he intends on, for all intents and purposes, annexing the West Bank or Judea and Samaria, as they say in Israel, to Israel proper. You may think, A, why is the finance minister saying this? And B, why isn't the head of the government saying this? Well, the finance ministry controls funding for what people outside of Israel would term the Israeli settlements inside the West Bank there. So he's that was sort of his pet project. He's from a settlement. And so he linked this specifically with Trump coming back. Now that America is going to have a president that's going to be more favorable to Israel than what we've seen so far, he tweeted, quote, 2025, the year of sovereignty in Judea and Samaria. Well, the day after Smotrich made that comment, President Trump announced his new ambassador to Israel. I'll read his statement right here. Quote, I am pleased to announce that the highly respected former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, has been nominated to be the United States ambassador to Israel. Mike has been a great public servant, governor, and leader in faith for many years. He loves Israel and the people of Israel, and likewise, the people of Israel love him. Mike will work tirelessly to bring about peace in the Middle East. End quote. So, for a little bit of context, Mr. Huckabee famously ran for president a couple times in 2008, 2015. He's the former governor of Arkansas, brought a bit of respectability back to that office after Governor Clinton. He is also an ordained Baptist minister. And if you wanted to show your not just support for Israel, but send a message that Israel can, or at least the current conservative government in Israel can do what they want. They don't have to worry about restrictions from Washington. They don't have to worry about international outcries about them being a conservative government in Israel. Go full steam ahead with your program. Mike Huckabee, appointing him as the ambassador to Israel is probably the biggest way you could have possibly done that. This is what Mr. Huckabee said back in 2017 while he was visiting Israel.
My feelings personally, and I'm speaking only as a person, I think Israel would only be acting on the property it already owns. I think Israel has title deed to Judea and Samaria. There are certain words I refuse to use. There is no such thing as a West Bank. It's Judea and Samaria. There's no such thing as a settlement. Their communities, their neighborhoods, their cities. There's no such thing as an occupation.
You don't hear anybody in America or in any country outside of Israel talking like that, like saying that Israel should annex the West Bank. Trump, for his part, has not said anything just as of yet, and it's still early days, but the fact that this is being discussed both from the Israeli side and from the American side in these early days, I think sets a very good, at least general vision that we can expect this administration to go down once Trump actually enters the White House.
Right, it's still talk at this site at this stage, but it shows that this is probably going to be one of the biggest things under discussion, at least, as Donald Trump sits in the White House. That's what's going to be we're going to be talking about. And this is another heads explode moment, I think. I mean, we all remember when, was it every US president has promised, I think, was it going all the way back to Bill Clinton? They've promised that they would move the US embassy to Jerusalem and recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Donald Trump was the one that actually did this, and this was a moment where all the foreign policy so-called experts' heads exploded. Donald Trump is going to lead to war, this is going to be all this violence, yada, yada, yada. Of course, it didn't, and instead it was Joe Biden's term that you had war and violence, and it was weakness and withdrawing support from Israel that led to war and violence, not strength and increasing support to Israel that you saw under Donald Trump. But again, this is going to this is a heads explode around the world moment. Joseph Borrell, the EU's kind of foreign policy chief, he was spouting off on Twitter about what a horrible thing this is. And do you think this is going to be something that will be massively controversial around the rest of the world? Within Israel, there's still political division there. Within the United States, I mean, how do you see that?
Well, again, it's still early days. Trump is known for saying, making a lot of promises to appeal to his base or to get the ball rolling for certain things, but he doesn't necessarily intend on fulfilling them, like, say, arresting Hillary Clinton, as much as I would have loved to have seen that. But as you mentioned, heads are already explaining. The German government, for their part, have already put out a statement. And I also think it's interesting that this does parallel a little bit with, you go back to his first term in office, and when they introduced the peace agreement, the proposed peace agreement f between Israel and a state of Palestine. And it involved Israel annexing a lot of the territory in the West Bank, a lot more than what most of the international community would have been comfortable giving to Israel. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, for his part, said, I'm okay with negotiating on this being the basis of the agreement. That obviously ended up not happening, but Trump has made offers like this before. And I also think Trump is coming into the second administration knowing a little bit more what he can and can't get away with. Before, he was still testing out the waters with a lot of things, and he was, I mean, he likes to market himself as a disruptor, but he doesn't want to be too much of a disruptor because this was a new role for him. He didn't know what he could get away with. He didn't know all the repercussions. I think he has a much better idea of that now, and I think he has a lot more thicker skin now in not listening to what other people tell him he can and can't do. So I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but if it was going to happen in some form or another, it would be under President Trump.
And I think probably this time he is like he is, you know, his book is Art of the Deal. I think he was coming more the first time in the, well, I can make both sides sit down and we can have a deal. I think having experienced it firsthand, he's probably now much more aware that the Palestinians don't really want a peace process. They don't want an independent Palestinian state. Really, what they want is to kill Jews.
You're hearing a lot of his appointees, both for the coming government as well as people surrounding his transition team, like almost all of them saying nobody in Israel right now wants to talk about a two-state solution, and they're putting it diplomatically. But the fact that it's being said across the board says that that's what Trump's attitude is towards a two-state solution going forward now.
So I think I could see us seeing more just straightforward support for Israel rather than a push for a peace process and a Palestinian state, the way that things began with initially.
We've covered this general trend quite a bit on last Wednesday's program as well, of Trump not even being in the White House as of yet. And already there are rumblings that there are big things coming for Israel, specifically tied with him working out at least temporary solutions to some of Israel's problems. But there are big things coming with the American-Israeli relationship. If anybody would like to learn more about that, I highly recommend them go back and watch that program we filmed earlier in the week. That would give a good summary. Of course, we're not expecting this to be the final peace deal that'll finally bring stability and peace in the region. So there will be certainly escalating problems in the long run in this area. But already, again, Trump's not in the White House, and we're seeing a real blossoming of the Israeli-American relationship just with him being the president-elect.
Right, and what we talked about on Wednesday's show is that this prophecy that we come back to so much for Donald Trump, and that was a big part of the reason why we expected him back to the White House in 2 Kings 14, that as we talked about on that show, as part of the former prophets, Amos confirms that there is a prophecy of a modern-day Jeroboam. It brings, you know, Israel in the Middle East. It's the nation of Judah. I mean, properly, we probably should be calling it Judah because Israel refers to a lot more than just them. But it talks about this king Jeroboam recovering something for Judah as well as for those northern tribes of Israel. And you look at the history, and during the days of Jeroboam the second, anciently, Judah had a fantastic time. Judah expanded its territory, had a time of great stability. So because of this, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory has talked about Judah really benefiting from Donald Trump's time in office. He talked about how this verse in 2 Kings 14 ties the politics of US and Judah together. So as you see Donald Trump coming in and doing some good things for the United States, we're going to see him come in, and Bible prophecy, it strongly indicates he's going to do some very good things for Judah. And I think the news that we've seen even since Wednesday's show really clearly demonstrates that. And like we talked about on that show, of course, he doesn't Unless there's national repentance, that's not going to fundamentally solve all of America's sins. And then unless America repents and turns around, well, America is going to fall. And then that fall affects Judah massively. And at that point, well, they will need to go and their security situation will be massively compromised. They will need to turn to another power to help them. And Judah is going to fall at the same time as the United States. So it doesn't fix all of Israel's problems. But certainly that things are stabilized in Judah. Just like we need to get a message out to the United States, we have to get a message out to Judah. And so that stability will allow that message to go out. So we're looking at fulfilled prophecy with Donald Trump's return in the United States. And I think we're looking already at fulfilled prophecy going on in Judah. We'll get a last little rundown of news from the Middle East from Mihailo.
Yes, so Axios published an article today with comments from Amos Hochstein, Biden's envoy to try and sort out the Israel-Hezbollah war. And according to Hochstein, quote, there is a shot of getting a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah organized. He said that they are hopeful we can get it. In that front, Strategic Affairs Minister of Israel, Ron Dermer, who's probably one of the closest allies of Benjamin Netanyahu, has been in Washington earlier in the week talking with Hochstein and some of these other decision makers in the White House foreign policy team. This is what Axios wrote, quote, a U.S. official said the meetings with Dermer were productive and closed many of the remaining gaps between the U.S. and Israel regarding the text of the ceasefire agreement and a side letter Israel has requested. Further down, the letter would include a U.S. commitment allowing Israel to take military action in Lebanon if the Lebanese army and UN peacekeepers don't prevent Hezbollah from reestablishing military activity near the border or from smuggling heavy weapons into Lebanon, end quote. So if they're already writing the text for this as a draft, we've seen almost weekly statements from Hezbollah and actions from Hezbollah showing how desperate they are to end the situation for the war there. If this is the final agreement that a ceasefire is based off of, it looks like, at least on paper, what we know right now, a pretty good deal for Israel, achieving everything they've been asking for. We've been down this road before in 2005, and look what's happened, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's a loophole found to take away some of those additions, but going back to what you asked me about before is if we can expect Barack Obama and his apparatus to jab at Israel one last time. If this is in the works and if Netanyahu manages to give Biden a photo op with a major foreign policy win like this before he gets out of office, that might even be incentive for him while he's sitting in the White House to not let something like that happen. We'll have to wait and see, but Trump, for his part, has said he wants the war in Israel finished up before he takes office, and the man mediating before he takes office is Biden, so we could see a peace deal between Israel and Hezbollah hashed out pretty soon.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo, and now we will go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Wednesday morning, Russian warplanes fired a volley of missiles at civilian targets in Kyiv, Ukraine. That is the capital of Ukraine, of course. It's way out in the west of the country, hundreds of miles from the battle lines. And this was notable because it marks the first time that Russia has fired missiles on the city of Kyiv in several months. And the Ukrainians were able to intercept these, from what we can tell. But there are fears that this could be the start of a new campaign just before the winter cold sets in to take out Ukraine's energy infrastructure and freeze the people. We've seen several times at earlier phases of the war that Russia has specifically targeted power plants and other aspects of energy infrastructure. And that has normally been timed before or during the winter months just to, you know, cause as much suffering as possible for the most civilians possible. So this could be the start of another of those campaigns. Much of Russia's strategy so far has been about targeting Ukrainian civilians in various ways, terrorizing them with drones, destroying their apartments and public spaces, and leaving them without water and roads, and just doing anything possible to kind of wear them down, to make them want to put pressure on the Ukrainian government to surrender. So this would be nothing new. to see another campaign against the power grid in Kyiv. And then another development from the war this week is that Vladimir Putin has started to really intensify his focus on the region of Kursk. That's the Russian region that Ukrainian forces invaded back in August. And Putin had given his military a deadline of October 1st to evict the Ukrainians from this Russian regions. And his general started to move some forces to that area to accomplish that. But that deadline came and went without much change. And then the next several weeks saw the lines there move very little as well. But this week, Russia has massed tens of thousands of Russian and North Korean soldiers there, and they've started pushing hard against the Ukrainians. So a big offensive is underway here in Kursk. Reports from the area say that the Russians are now launching an assault every 10 to 15 minutes. So, you know, just a remarkable rate of assaults that we see happening there. And the Ukrainians are entrenched very well in their positions here. So it's a difficult task for the Russians, and some very grim records are being broken for the number of casualties per day on the Russian side, apparently close to 2,000 Russian casualties in a single day, sometimes partly in this area, but also combined with what's happening in eastern Ukraine. But in either case, this is just a really stunning pace of assaults and just an extremely vicious flashpoint here. And so far, the lines still don't appear to have moved much. Ukraine is still occupying hundreds of square miles of Russian territory here, and it's still forcing the Russians to divert a lot of manpower and other resources away from the real front lines of the war there in eastern Ukraine. But if Putin keeps on concentrating so much of his attention here, throwing so many men into this area, then it's hard to see how Ukraine could continue to hold this for much longer. So there is a lot to keep an eye on here as this full-scale war draws close to the 1,000-day mark.
So what do you think is behind this? Is this something that would happen anyway, because obviously Putin wants to win this war no matter what? Is there some acceleration because he's trying to, you know, he's kind of got Donald Trump's going to go all out for a negotiated settlement, so I want to grab as much as possible ahead of that settlement? Like, what do you think is behind this action?
Yeah, I think it very well could be timed to try to evict the Ukrainians from Kursk before January 20th.
Because Ukraine and Kursk was always about bargaining position, I guess, right? Like, it was all about they have territory that they're happy to give up in exchange for something that Russia's already conquered.
That's right. And I think that Ukraine anticipated a Trump victory, and that's why they waged this very surprising offensive to actually take some Russian territory. They wanted to have the best possible bargaining position before President Trump comes into office and likely forces a negotiated, you know, peace of some kind. And I think that you're exactly right. I think with the Russians, they want to be in the best position possible come January 20th, you know, in the likely event that that some sort of negotiation is forced.
So do you think we're heading for the end of the Ukrainian war on a Russian victory? Like, that they are winning?
Well, I wouldn't say Russia's winning necessarily. To me, for the last year or so, it looks like both sides are losing. It's very tragic the way this has unfolded so slowly, just at this agonizing rate, bleeding both sides in just a heartbreaking ways to watch, really. But it's difficult to really predict what will happen with Trump in office. Of course, he has on numerous occasions talked about forcing peace, forcing Ukraine to give up some of its people and some of its land in order for Russia to feel that its interests are being, you know, respected in the area. But then this week, you know, you and Mr. Miller and Mr. Zekich there were talking about Trump's appointments. And one of the big ones there is Congressman Mike Waltz, who is a real China hawk and a real Russia hawk. He's talked about actually empowering Ukraine to use more weaponry with longer ranges to be able to strike targets well across the border inside of Russia proper. So that, I think, surprised a lot of those who feared that Trump's reelection would, you know, be kind of an ignominious end for Ukraine, and this negotiated peace that is in the short term perhaps good, but ultimately empowers Russia to just take more of the land and people. So I think we just have to keep our eye on it and see what happens.
So this war hasn't been the easy gobble of Ukraine that Vladimir Putin seemed like he hoped it would initially. It looks like maybe he's going to be forced to just take a chunk of Ukraine for now. Another chunk of Ukraine, I should say, given that he took a chunk, of course, 10 years ago, back when he took the Crimea. Is that a major setback? Is that the end of Vladimir Putin that we've heard so much about from Western media?
Well, I think that something that we can say with confidence is that whatever happens with Kursk, this area we've been talking about, whatever happens with the power grid in Kyiv, and regardless of any other immediate developments in the war, whatever happens with any of that, we should expect Putin to emerge from all this still in power and actually strengthened. And that's because of what Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said about the role that Putin will play in a coming Asian alliance. There are several Bible passages that talk about this colossal end-time alliance of Asian nations. There are details about it in the books of Daniel and Joel and Revelation. And then there's one especially detailed passage about this in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. If you look at verse 2 of Ezekiel 38, it says that this Asian alliance will be led by a man that the New King James version of the Bible calls, quote, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, end quote. And Mr. Fleury has said that these three names refer to Russia and then to two of its main cities. And he said that this passage is describing none other than Vladimir Putin. And he explains all those passages in detail in his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And he holds them up alongside current events to show, you know, really where we are on the timeline. And it all shows that Putin's most consequential days lie still ahead for him. So whatever may play out in the near term, we should expect Putin to live through the current war and then to go on to lead this massive Asian alliance.
And we talked more about this issue of what we expect, like Donald Trump's relationship with Russia, what we expect that to do on Ukraine on Wednesday's show. So if you want to know more about that, you can go and look that over. And you know, more has happened in Asia than just that war and even just Donald Trump coming to power or making more appointments. Can you give us the rundown of other stories for Asia?
Sure. Yes. First up is South Korea. After Trump's re-election, the South Koreans are talking more and more about developing a nuclear arsenal. President Trump has made clear that he's not happy with some of the details of the U.S. alliance with South Korea. He thinks America pays too much for that. And in the spirit of putting America first, he has kind of implied that he may even be willing to walk away from that alliance. And that's extremely alarming to many South Koreans. They're unsure now if the U.S. would really come to their defense if they were attacked by North Korea or by Russia or China. And so now that Trump is returning, many in the South are saying, we can't count on America. We need to be ready to defend ourselves on our own. And that includes a nuclear deterrent. So their leaders are now debating the development of a domestic nuclear weapon. And a lot of this is intensified by what we see with Ukraine. You know, this war has terrified many people around the world. And everyone understands that Ukraine used to have nuclear weapons. But then America pressured them into giving those up and promised to defend Ukraine if they were attacked. And Ukraine did, of course, give them up. And now they're being ruthlessly attacked and receiving far less American support than they expected to. So the lesson is clear in South Korea. And I think that we should expect more discussions, not just in South Korea, but also in Japan, Taiwan, Germany, Saudi Arabia. Several countries, I think, now are going to be discussing and maybe making moves toward developing nuclear weapons, since America First raises a lot of questions about their security.
And I think,
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, before you move on to your next story, I think it is really interesting to see this, because we did kind of have this nuclear arms race, say, in the 50s, where, you know, Tom Lehrer had his famous song, Who's Next?, where it seems everyone's getting the bomb. And he says, well, we'll try to remain serene and calm when Alabama gets the bomb. But back then, getting the bomb was much harder than it is today. Like, that was cutting edge physics, at least cutting edge applied physics. Now it's not. Like, now a lot of these countries have decades of experience running quite advanced nuclear power stations and things like that. Like, it is not the technological hurdle that it once was. It is much, much more simply about political choice. None of these countries will have a hard time getting physicists and engineers to help them design this. So you can see countries getting the bomb much more quickly than the kind of, I think that the arms race or the nuclear arms race that has kind of been fixed in our imaginations because of how it took place in the 50s and 60s, and then how it's gone on since then in, say, more second and third rate countries rather than modern sophisticated powers.
It's a very good point. And I think that that's especially relevant in these, you know, technologically cutting edge nations like Japan and South Korea. I've read analyses saying that in those two nations in particular, the time between their decision to build the bomb and actually having a miniaturized nuclear weapon that they could put on a missile, maybe as little as 6 or 8 months, just because they've already got the know-how and they're full of engineers and physicists of all stripes. So it really would not, as you said, be the hurdle that it once was. But yeah, I wanted to also squeeze in one other quick story here about India and its trade with Russia. Many Western countries, of course, are trying to reduce trade with Russia to punish it for its war on Ukraine and to kind of hinder Russia's ability to keep on financing that war. And India is a democracy, and it often tries to portray itself as a partner to the West. So America and other nations had hoped that India would join them in these measures, but instead the opposite has happened. India's trade with Russia is just soaring to new heights. This week, new data showed that trade between the two of them is now at $66 billion per year, largely consisting of Indian imports of Russian oil. And this is a fivefold increase over the level of trade from just 5 years ago. So a remarkable level of increase there. And this means that India is now Russia's second largest trading partner, just behind China. So this shows that whatever the Indians may say about trying to be a partner to the West, they're actually a major enabler of Russia's war, and they're moving further away from America and deeper into the Russian camp.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Well, I think we've seen really two massive issues dominate trumpet world today. We started with the rise of the spirit of the Holy Roman Empire there in Europe, and then we've spent pretty much the rest of the show talking about the world responding to Donald Trump. And we're working right now on our next Trumpet print edition. These are the big stories in that Trumpet print edition as well. If you're not subscribed, I would really urge you to get the Trumpet. You can sign up for that on our website, thetrumpet.com. It's a free subscription, comes out 10 times a year, so almost monthly. We're very happy to send that to you. It goes out all around the world. You can also download the PDF and look at that too, but you know, the Trumpet print magazine, it's tactile, you can read it. I think I find it much easier to digest and dig into things in print. So I'd really encourage you to go ahead and get that. There's no other follow-up. You know, we don't sell your address information. We don't bombard you with other information and contact. All we do is we send you a card about once a year saying, hey, do you keep wanting to get this magazine? We don't want to waste your time and ours if you're no longer interested. But if you want to keep getting it, we'll be happy to keep on sending that to you. And so that's a great place to go to dig in more detail into what we've talked about on today's show. But the point I really want to leave you with is these two stories are probably two of the biggest, most specific prophecies that we've been focusing on in recent times. The return of Donald Trump and the rise of the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. And Bible prophecy is driving your world news. You know, sometimes on this show, we're talking about news stories that you will not have seen everywhere else because our news gathering is informed by Bible prophecy. And I think that's great, and I think it's important that we do that. That hasn't been this week. You know, this week, we've been talking to you about the news stories that have dominated all of the news coverage, but we're able to tell you much more about them and about the spiritual dimension or the spiritual warfare going on behind some of them, or where some of these are leading in a way that you can't get anywhere else. Like, Bible prophecy is driving your world news. You cannot pick up a newspaper, if you still pick up newspapers, you cannot go to a news website without seeing the fruits, the events of Bible prophecy. This is not some little academic thing. Your news and your world is full of it. So I would really encourage you to take this opportunity to dig into Bible prophecy. The Trumpet subscription and all of our books and booklets, it's a great way to do that. And do that, yes, to dig in and understand world news so you can understand the world that you live in. But that's not even the most important reason. You can dig in to understand the Bible, to bring the Bible alive so that every time you see the news, you hear it on the radio, you look at a news website, truth from the Bible is jumping out at you. Dig into it to see your Father, to see God the Father and his hand in world events, and then in your life much more clearly. Like, this is about understanding the world, yes, but it's about understanding God, what he wants from the world, what he wants from you and from your life, and what he has planned for you. So I'd really encourage you to use our website, thetrumpet.com, to use that magazine to educate yourself, to use a phrase that you hear about from the left. You know, do the work to understand Bible prophecy, and you will be rewarded with major changes in your life. That is about all that we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back on Wednesday for our standard show then. Thank you to Isaac Lorenz and George Haddad for engineering and production. You can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. You can leave us a comment. I'm sure we will probably get more hate mail than usual because we've talked about anti-Semitic attacks and Israel. So if you have anything positive to say as well, we would also love to hear from you on that too. You can, of course, leave those comments. You can get in touch with us. You can keep watching the show across Rumble, across YouTube, kpcg.fm, your favorite podcast app. We're available on all of those different avenues. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back on Wednesday. And until then, keep watching your world.